Welcome to episode 47 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I'm talking with Jeff Ramsey, who's the Washington Office on Latin America's assistant director of their Venezuela program. And he contributes to their Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights blog. So Jeff, thanks so much for taking some time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, so the topic today, obviously, is Venezuela. And as I was saying to you just a little bit earlier, there's a million things we could potentially talk about, all of them mostly depressing. But let me just start with like a basic one, especially with how it connects to WOLA. So WOLA just released a statement that the international community should pressure Venezuela, have coordinated pressure, but not through economic sanctions. So what does that mean? What other avenues could have an effect?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's important to be clear. We don't really reject sanctions outright. What we've said is that sanctions on exports of Venezuelan crude or on imports of refined oil should be avoided because of the toll they would have on Venezuela's people. You know, they would likely make the scarcity of basic goods and medicine become much more acute and would probably fuel the migration crisis that we're seeing. Now, that's not to say that we don't think sanctions can be a useful tool in the toolbox. We've actually supported U.S. debt sanctions that were announced in August because, you know, we think they contain important exceptions for things like humanitarian assistance and because, most importantly, they wouldn't apply to new debt that was issued by a legitimate national assembly.
Okay.
But I mean, just you know, in general, you know, we beyond the specific kind of sanctions, we know just from looking at the research that sanctions are much more successful when they're multilateral, when they're tied to specific concrete outcomes on the ground, and when they're paired with a clear communication strategy. So that's why in a lot of our advocacy around Venezuela, we focus more on the importance of international unity and the need for the U.S. to really hammer out a strategy in close coordination with the region and with the European Union.
Yeah.
We just think it's...
No, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, it's a matter of, you know, looking at past history and seeing that, you know, the U.S. going alone in some kind of cowboy approach is just far less likely to be effective.
Yeah, I mean, and I agree. I mean, obviously, anybody who studies Latin America knows how the Cuba embargo has worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've just been grappling with, okay, well, what, even if it weren't the Trump administration, which doesn't have a very much leverage or respect in Latin America, you know, how much can the U.S. do? And, you know, at a certain point, it's unclear unless there's really a lot of buy-in by the region and whoever else is funding Latin America, which includes China.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a limit to what that can accomplish. Now, the other thing that it's, you know, at least some, particularly in Europe, had hoped was that dialogue might work. Now, dialogue recently was put in quote unquote indefinite recess. In your opinion, do you think dialogue can have a meaningful impact on the crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the bet of the international community is that, you know, I think the consensus is that the crisis in Venezuela needs to be resolved through some kind of negotiated, peaceful, democratic process. That's obviously not what we saw in the Dominican Republic. I think for a lot of reasons, I mean, the government feels like, you know, it's frankly not on its, in that much of a vulnerable position. They don't really feel like they need to make meaningful concessions. But I do think that, you know, not only are we hopeful that dialogue can play a part in transition, I think it's pretty much the only reliable solution to the crisis. Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's also true that the intermediators in the Dominican talks weren't necessarily the most reliable. I mean, Zapatero himself participated in essentially browbeating the opposition, like pressuring them to sign this flawed, imperfect accord that the government was presenting, that offered, you know, very little in the way of specific guarantees. So while the Dominican process, you know, I think was flawed and seems to have failed, I think, you know, we can't really count negotiations or some kind of dialogue out.
Yeah, and I that was interesting because the government came up with a plan, and then the opposition came up with their own plan, and since they didn't sign it, then suddenly they were the ones who were blamed.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, okay, well, it's an indefinite recess. And I wonder whether if you put a Venn diagram together of what is the same in both of them,
mm-hmm.
that ideally that would be the starting point of something, but instead it was like, boom, it's over. And everybody went home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's sort of the thing. I mean, there were sort of three different, we have a post on this on the blog, actually. And there were sort of three separate documents. There was the opposition's, there was the government's proposal, very limited in the way of specifics. The opposition came back with their counterproposal that offered, you know, very tight sort of timetables for some of these guarantees. And then there was actually a document that was presented by the foreign ministers that were observing the process back in December. And it's actually much more like what you're talking about, something in between both proposals. But for some reason, that didn't appear to go anywhere. I mean, just the whole process itself was very weird. I mean, I think the fact that the Mexican government pulled out in the middle of it, I think, really reflected the sort of the way it was perceived as not entirely a serious initiative by some.
Right. And I think you're right that there was the strong impression that the government didn't feel it needed to make any concessions,
mm-hmm.
which then raises the question, okay, how do you put the government in a position where it feels that it needs to?
Right.
And that's something that we haven't really figured out.
Yeah. And that's another thing. I mean, you know, I do think though that the position of the strength of Maduro is overstated. I mean, the fact that they, you know, the Delcy and Jorge Rodriguez are sort of, you know, they're sort of perceived internationally as these rabble rousers, and you know, Delcy last year, you know, tried to clamor her way into a regional summit and made headlines that way. But the fact that they had to essentially go to Santo Domingo, throw a temper tantrum in public, and make a big show in front of the cameras about signing their own accord, you know, I think really isn't ideal in terms of optics. So I think the government is aware that their hand is weak and getting weaker. Yeah, and you know, I think that's very much sort of the way that the international community, I mean, when we talk to people in state or in countries from the Lima group, I mean, that's sort of varied as well, that the Maduro is not really coming at this from a place of strength.
And what's your sense, what do Venezuelans in Venezuela think? I mean, do they see the government as having a weaker hand? Do they see Maduro increasingly as just completely off the rails?
I mean, I think it's interesting, actually. If you look at polling, so that analysis is one pollster that we follow very closely. Another is there's this Bene Barometro report that comes out periodically. And the most recent one from December actually showed that the favorable, the favorability rating of Maduro is somewhere around 30%. Which A is extremely surprising for a country that's undergoing hyperinflation and where,
yeah,
you know, basic goods and medicine are scarce. But also it parallels the favorability rating of the opposition, the MUD. If you ask people whether they view the MUD in a favorable light, roughly the same proportion say yes as those who say they view Maduro favorably.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just think it sort of, you know, I think it unfortunately speaks to the lingering polarization in Venezuela and
broadly the sort of lack of the lack of faith that Venezuelans have in the Moon leadership so far.
Yeah, because I mean, you're seeing too. You just follow Maduro on Twitter, and you just say, like, what are you doing? He's having all these things where he's eating. He's pulling an empanada out of a drawer. He's dancing and just thinking, wow, what do Venezuelans think? But it makes more sense if they have this sense of, okay, if I have to choose between him and the opposition, well, I'd rather not have a coup or upheaval and just stick with that.
Totally.
Now, the next question then is, if the variety of things that are happening now aren't working, at least for now, can you envision a scenario other than a coup that could actually change the government?
Yes, and I do. I don't know. I mean, I think we're.
And I'm not asking you to predict a coup, but you know, what other ways could reasonably work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that again, it's the fact that we're even talking about a coup is.
It's crazy.
I mean, it's crazy for a variety of reasons. I don't think we can count out some kind of negotiated process, some kind of transition. Once the government fully appreciates its weakened position in all of this. However, I do think that like. The other reality is that the military is a black box. I mean, there's no question that there are factions that must be critical of Maduro. There's increasing reports of dissatisfaction among the ranks. In January, there was this internal document that came out that suggested that I think it's something like 75% of the National Guard had been posted in their bases and some kind of high alert, and that the upper ranks are concerned about low morale. I mean, I think that there is clearly dissatisfaction within the security forces of Venezuela, but I think the international community needs to be really careful in expecting something better than what Venezuela's government currently looks like to come out of a coup led by Venezuelan security forces. I mean, we're talking about military that has been benefiting from imports from, now they're in charge of PDVSA. There's widespread allegations of corruption and involvement in drug trafficking along the borders. I mean, I just don't think that it's A, advisable, or B, realistic to sort of see the Venezuelan military as positive, meaningful agents of change in this.
Well, I agree, and that was getting to my next question. But the question of the black box, it reminded me a bit of the end of the Soviet Union, which pretty much people didn't predict because there was no way of knowing exactly what's going on inside. So something could happen in Venezuela tomorrow, and unless you're really deep in the government. We're not going to know.
Right.
And thinking about the military, I thought too, various times I've blogged about the possible irony that the coup attempts that Chavez himself made in 1992, which are right now being celebrated by the government as really patriotic insurrections, were done by lower-level officers against what they saw as corrupt generals tied to the government. And then, do we have any way of knowing, like, whether those splits reoccur in sort of an opposite way now, or do we just not know?
I mean, again, I think the Venezuelan government has been very – Maduro in particular has been very good at sort of – buying the silence and paying off the leadership of the Venezuelan military. I mean, they even have a television channel. I think as of 2013, I think Maduro announced a television channel and gave that to the army. I mean, this is a security force that has benefited from all kinds of goodies. And yeah, like you say, I mean, there's just very little incentive for these kind of splits and cracks to become public until they do.
Yeah, and of course, then if you're successful in buying the military off, then you're getting in a position where the military might actively feel threatened by a change of government because it figures it's going to be purged. And so it has potentially the incentive to stick it out to the bitter end,
mm-hmm.
Depending on how far those benefits are trickling down.
Yeah, absolutely. And that just to real quick, I mean, that's kind of another, just going back to our concerns about sanctions. That's another thing that we've publicly sort of put a pin in, that these, you know, targeted sanctions against Venezuelan officials, you know, they may be important domestically here in the U.S. and seen as a kind of signaling, you know, that the U.S. does not support violations of human rights and corruption, but effectively on the ground, you know, we're concerned that they reduce the likelihood of their support for some kind of transition and ultimately raise the exit costs of these people, because you know you're essentially telling them you know that you better support Maduro, otherwise the alternative is a jail cell in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. Now shifting gears a bit, the government says, okay, we're gonna have presidential elections. What's your position? And I don't know whether there's a WOLA position, but your position on whether the opposition should participate in those elections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so our position is ultimately, I don't think, I mean, we have no position on whether or not they should. I mean, I don't think anybody would fault the opposition for not participating in these elections without electoral guarantees. I mean, there's just so much potential for fraud that I don't think, you know, anybody could fault them for engaging in some kind of boycott. But ultimately, our position is that whether or not they participate, they need to do so as one and under some kind of unity banner. You know, whether they go into boycott, I think that they need to do so collectively, right? Not like we saw in the municipal elections in December, in which there were some parties that participated and others who didn't. I mean, that kind of division really only helps Maduro in this.
Yeah, and there's so many. I've seen a lot of comparisons to Chile in the late 1980s. And one of the key components for Chile was that after many years, the opposition finally united, or mostly united. The Communist Party was not part of the Concertación, but mm-hmm. the socialists, who had been very radical, moderated, and they finally came together, which at least gave them, okay, we're going to have a single candidate, and we're all behind this candidate. But thinking back to what you were saying about polling, is that in Chile the Concertación had a pretty good approval, you know, and so it's like I even wonder if there was free and fair elections. I mean, what would the results look like between a MUD candidate and the government? I wonder. I mean, I assume the MUD would win, but you know, they're so unpopular.
Right, and the people, their leaders that actually do poll well are either in prison or are restricted from.
Well, there is that. Yes, I would say though to have free and fair elections, you have to release people from prison who are there for political reasons.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you were in the opposition, if you're leading the opposition, what would you do? Realistically, what can somebody do?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is sort of my personal observation.
Yeah.
This is
you
know, I don't think we are. Obviously, the opposition is in such a difficult position that it's hard to fault them for anything. But you know, I do think
that's true.
The we know that there are some sectors within the opposition, Henry Falcón, Manuel Rosales' party. I mean, there are sort of spoilers within the opposition that have already signaled their willingness to participate in elections, no matter how flawed they are. So I think knowing that and knowing that there will be some willingness to participate, I think the opposition may be best suited by going forward and trying to really get their act together and present a unified candidate through an intense process of, you know, internal negotiations, knowing full well that in doing so, there's absolutely no guarantee, and very, you know, the potential for fraud is extremely high.
Yeah, I mean, and I agree with that. And I've been on the fence about participation, though. I've started to just lean on the, well, you don't have a whole lot to lose because you can easily, even if you lose, you can point out the fraud that was involved. Mm-hmm. But I kind of wonder, you know, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights issued just a really scathing report just recently about the human rights problem in Venezuela. And one of the things was, I think it was in that report, that they said they don't recognize the legitimacy of the April elections. And I wondered whether, if the international community says we don't recognize them, that that puts the opposition in a difficult place, because if they participate, it's almost like they are rejecting those international voices when, in fact, they agree with most of what they say. Does that make sense?
I mean, I think that's the concern. But I also think that you know, this kind of goes back to the idea of, you know, the opposition's lack of unity. But I think you can overcome that through a very clear communications strategy, you know, internationally and domestically, right? Saying we are going for, you know, participating in these elections to highlight the fraud and to point out, you know, specific violations in Venezuelan people's right to elect their leaders, right? I mean, I don't know. I think that they're provided. I think there's going to be a lot of temptation from the international community to judge the opposition if they do decide to participate, and I think there just seems to be better coordination on that. I think it can be overcome with just sort of better messaging, frankly.
Yeah, and I mean, I think too. I want to make clear is that I don't mean to criticize the opposition. I had that question there was really aimed at, I don't know exactly how I would deal with this situation if I were in their shoes, because none of their solutions are very easy, and they're mm-hmm. dealing with this very large heterogeneous group of people, mm-hmm. And they're being criticized all the time for not having united. But I don't know how you effectively go about doing that with people with widely diverging views.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, you know, the other reality, though, is that, you know, going back to this sort of the relative weakness or strength of the Maduro government, you know, assuming that everything goes as expected and they have elections on April 22nd and they win, and Maduro claims that, you know, this is further example of his democratic legitimacy, the number of governments, particularly in the hemisphere, that will recognize the elections as legitimate, you know, it's the Alba countries, and that's it. You know, and I think it will see sort of an important group of countries that have been kind of on the fence in criticizing Maduro, or at least doing so publicly, being less afraid to condemn this sort of authoritarian slide that we've been seeing. I mean, a good example is Uruguay, right? They have not joined the Lima Group, but they have. They did vote for Venezuela's suspension from Mercosur. And if you talk to Uruguayan authorities, I know because some of my other work involves studying drug policy in Uruguay, and if you talk to Venezuelan authorities, they'll say, yeah, we don't recognize the Constituent Assembly, but we don't need to say so publicly because, you know, we're not looking for the legitimacy of our, you know, our Ministry of Agriculture. Like, it's an internal matter. But once you actually have a government that holds onto power through fraudulent elections, I think it's going to force the hand of these countries that have been reticent to join the Lima Group so far.
Okay, and that, you know, is a perfect place to end, because every other podcast that I've done on Venezuela has ended on this incredibly down note. So we can end on a somewhat up note, which is that there seems to be perhaps more consensus in the hemisphere that that criticism of the Venezuelan government is warranted. So with that, we are out of time. I've been talking with Jeff Ramsey, who is the Washington Office on Latin America's Associate Director of their Venezuela program. And again, Jeff, thank you so much.
Thanks again for having me.